and welcome to Pints with Treebeard. I'm Jameson Winter. I'm the dean of the upper school at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee. And today I'm joined not by Josh Edgren, but by Adam Lang. Adam, tell us about yourself.
Hi, I'm Adam Lang. I'm an educator, a weekend homesteader, and father of five. I'm excited to be on the podcast.
So today we've decided to talk about, well, maybe I should give context for the episode. I should say tonight, as in late tonight at 8:26 p.m., we have decided to talk about the idea of plodding through projects as fathers. As dads, we often have many things going on in our lives, many directions that we're pulled in, and some of those bigger projects, whether it's learning how to be a woodworker or replacing the kitchen counter or remodeling a room in your house or writing a book or any number of things, teaching yourself to play guitar or piano, can kind of take a back seat. But there's a certain craft to meticulously working through those as you get any margin in your life. And also balancing that margin, of course, with the fact that you have these greater duties, greater responsibilities, and greater tasks for your career, for your family, for your church that really need to take priority. So we wanted to talk about that, and it's fitting that we're talking about this now because Josh couldn't join us this week. He had greater duties that took him away from the podcast for a week, and that's normal and just part of life. And then you said you could pinch hit for him. So here we are on Thursday night, right before this episode releases, probably. And we're here to talk about it. So why don't you just start by listing a couple of the bigger projects that you tend to be working on these days?
Yeah. So you should know about me that I like to learn and I like to know how to do everything. And so usually I have many more projects that I'm interested in doing than I can actually achieve at one time. I was thinking about it in preparation for the podcast, and I'm writing a novel, hoping to make it a series. I am reading like my life depends on it. Last year I read 100 books in the year, and I decided not to do that again. I'm just going for 50 this time.
Reasonable.
I'm an aspiring artist. I enjoy self-sufficiency, and so we've got our own little pretend homestead. It's not really a homestead, but we grow produce and can and make jams and things like that. We're slowly renovating a fixer-upper. We're homeschooling. I'd like to start a school. I am thinking about starting a business, and all that being said, I can't do all of that at the same time. So the main two projects, oh, and I'm finishing my MDiv. The main two projects right now are probably writing my novel and self-sufficiency because it's harvest season. So those are the two main ones right now.
Yeah, I saw the picture that you sent the other day that you're harvesting, what, a gallon of green beans a day right now?
Yeah. It's too many green beans. I did not mean to grow so many green beans. We just have jars and jars of green beans. At least we like it, but it is too many.
Yeah, at least it's not something vulgar like cauliflower.
Oh, no. I can't believe you even named it.
Yeah. So let's start by thinking through some principles. As we strive to be good husbands and fathers, as we strive to be good churchmen, as we strive to be good employees or business owners, we have people depending on us in many spheres of life. We need some principles to guide these bigger things because you know and I know that the temptation can be when you love something, whether that's writing a book. For me, it would be more building things, getting out in the shop, learning more carpentry skills and learning how to use hand tools. I've got a lot of antique hand tools that I've collected from mostly from my grandfather and great-grandfather, and my dad has passed those down to me, which is really fun and outstanding. And yet, I don't have the time in the day to become a master carpenter. I can be an amateur. I can build some things, and I can have fun out there and even make things for the home. But we need principles to guide us so that we don't overcorrect. Growing a gallon of green beans and having too much food isn't really a problem. It didn't necessarily take much more time. And now you have this blessing that you can pass on to others, perhaps. But spending way too much time out in the shop doesn't necessarily equal the same kind of benefit, right? It does take much more time, not necessarily for the same kind of profit and the same kind of grace that can be given out to others. So one of the principles that I thought I would just mention here is the idea of not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. I think Josh mentioned that a few weeks ago on the podcast, and it's something that I heard, I think, first on an ESPN talk show, which is surprising, but I heard someone say that, and it really stuck with me. I had never heard it before. It was years and years ago, and I realized, there's some wisdom here that if I'm striving for perfection in my craft or whatever I'm doing, I can actually let that get in the way of doing a good job and just finishing it and moving on to the next responsibility, the next task, which is part of what we're doing here tonight, right? This podcast is not going to be edited like our other podcasts would be, which aren't all that great to begin with, but still they have more polish on them than this one will, certainly. We're going to just put the audio together and kind of get it out there quickly. And that's okay, right? That keeps the project going. That keeps us progressing. That, you know, we're carving out whatever little margin we have to make the work continue. And it doesn't all have to be perfect. So how have you found that helpful in any of your particular endeavors?
Yeah, no, I think another way I've heard the same principle is practice makes progress. You know the phrase practice makes perfect, but then we aren't perfect right away, especially with something new. And so, yeah, looking at making progress rather than anything else. I think for myself, I think my book is a great example of this. When I got started on this, it was just, I had a few ideas. It's like, I have this idea for a setting. I have this idea for a theme. I have this idea for an overarching story. And hey, I think these fit together, and I really like it. And so I started thinking through these things, but it's been a long time rolling around in my head before I was writing much down. And then I said, okay, I think I've got it all planned out. I'm a writer now. And I went down, I sat down to write it, and it was harder to write than I expected. And the things that I wrote were not good. I just could read the sentences, say, wow, this is so bad. And I kind of reached a point where I could just give up. Said, well, you know, this was fun to imagine. You know, this was fun to world build in my mind. And this writing is really hard work. And if I had, I think that could have been okay. You know, I was just doing it for my own enjoyment. But I decided, no, I want to work at this, even though it's not perfect. And as I make progress on it, I have gotten better. And so, I think that's a great principle. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. It's better to finish things. And ultimately, you get better with practice. I think another example is as I'm drawing, my drawings have been really bad for a really long time. And I'm just now starting to feel like I'm getting good, like good enough that I actually want to show people what I did. And that's really exciting. But it was preceded by a lot of me looking at a drawing and saying, man, this is not perfect. But it's done now. And I'm going to try again with something else later and see that progress over time.
Yeah, it's interesting to think through how I've seen this idea, right? Practice makes progress, play out a little bit. They're similar, but not identical. One of the things that it makes me think is just how completing projects in one area builds confidence and this sense of accomplishment that then carries over into our other practices as fathers, right? So if I'm working on a project, actually before we sat down to record this, I was out just literally making bits and bits of progress. One of the boys from our church came over. He was looking for ways to help people and just said, reach out if you need help with anything. And I said, well, I've got a lot of concrete to bust up in the backyard. And I've mentioned that to you. And we got maybe another 10 cubic yards busted up, maybe a little more. And, you know, we were drenched with sweat by the end of it because it's 98 degrees down here and 110% humidity. And I can't look at that. All told, it's something at least the section of the driveway I want to pull up in the backyard to plant grass is at least 9.5 tons of concrete. I don't remember exactly how many cubic yards total, but I did the math and you can't just do that in a day. I mean, you can if you have the equipment for it. I have a sledgehammer from my great grandfather. And so I can't do that in a day with a sledgehammer, but we can, you know, chip away, make a little progress. and getting progress in that task and seeing it, seeing the physical result makes me think, oh, yeah, sure. We can go and record this podcast and put it out, or I can go and chip away at this book that I've wanted to read on top of what I'm doing for school to prepare. That's fine. I'll just get 5 pages, 10 pages done tonight and keep going, because there are certain tasks that you see the progress in, and that's maybe even particularly invigorating in a way for the book. It's harder to see. I mean, I guess you see the bookmark moving, but that's not the same as seeing a building, you know, erected from the dirt, or a garden that's literally bearing fruit and you're reaping and getting to eat this with your family. It's not the same kind of visual, tactile reward. So I think letting those little tasks be pushed forward by the progress you're making in other areas is really helpful.
Yeah. And I think that family worship is a great example of this too, because you don't want to let perfect be the enemy of good. If you're like me, which I hope none of you are that are listening, but if you're like me, you know, plan out this perfect routine of like, we're going to do this, and we're going to work on memorizing this, and we're going to sing this song, and then we're going to do this, and then every month we're going to change and do this. And, you know, it's not all necessary. You know, if I think I have something good here, I can pursue it. But if on a night all we're able to do is just pray together, that's good. You know, like if all we have time for is one verse of the song, that's good. And if I get into a mindset of, well, if I'm not able to do it just the way I want, then it's not worth doing. Well, then we don't make that progress. And it's a good opportunity to stop and examine our hearts too, because at the end of the day, it might be better to do all these things I plan for family worship. But if I'm not willing to pray with my family because I don't get to do it the way I want to, then that probably actually reveals something wrong in my heart.
Yeah, I think, man, that cuts deep, because it's something that I fight in myself, realizing that oftentimes we do the right things for the wrong reasons, and that doesn't make them not the right things. So they're still the right things to be doing. For instance, family worship, we can do that as fathers from any number of sinful motives, and sin can be mixed into our hearts, and yet it's still a blessing to our children to memorize a psalm or to sing a song or to pray together. That's still a blessing for them, even if our hearts are wrong in it in some way. But it's a good check to the motivation that I can see in myself sometimes, which is, right, this calling out to performative worship for the sake of saying I did it, right? Like, look at me, Lord, I did it. I checked it off of our list, right? And that's just straight from Satan. The desire should be, Lord, this is all we have, right? We offer this up to you, and this is all we have, and this is all we are and can do, is to pray to you and sing to you and memorize these psalms together. And this is our act of spiritual worship, right? We're making ourselves living sacrifices. We're renewing our minds according to your word, and it's not perfect. And we only got through a third of the quote-unquote order of worship for family worship tonight, but it is worship, and it's offered to you. Please take it, and take it with grace, and give us a return on what we're offering you. You know, equip our hearts to see you more fully. And then it prepares you. It builds the muscles, right? Every time that you make a little bit of progress against that inner self that says, ah, maybe not tonight, right? We're tired. We're home so late, whatever. Every time that you do something instead of nothing, you're building up the resolve to continue when it's hard.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important principle to recognize too. We were actually talking about this in my church's small group this week, short version, we were talking about how sometimes it's just hard to find joy in the Lord. It's hard to turn to the Lord in prayer. It's easier to turn to a phone. It's easier to turn to social media. It's easier, whatever. And something I was arguing was that it's only easier because that's our habit, right? Like, it's easier to turn to my phone than to the Lord in prayer if what I've been doing for the last several weeks is turning to my phone whenever I am afraid or discouraged. So there's a good news there, that turning to the Lord in prayer is easier when you make a habit of it. And so I think so much of the plotting, you know, going and doing these big projects, which we'll continue to talk about, but working on these big projects that are not always the most essential, I need to do this right now sort of thing, we can get there by cultivating discipline, by building habits, by practicing and repeating the tasks. Because at the end of the day, I think of the Gravitas episode, at the end of the day, there aren't shortcuts. You know, like I there's no shortcut to me becoming a good sketch artist. There's no shortcut for me being able to write good prose, or maybe even editing to good prose. But I can get there with practice. It just takes time. And if I'm putting in that practice over time, then I do get there, even if it's not as quickly as I want to.
And one of the things that can help with that, as you identify projects that you want to pursue, you identify, well, maybe we should start here. One principle is that you just have to sort things, right? You have to get things in their proper categories. You have to say, these are my responsibilities that are essential because no one else in the world can be a husband to my wife or a father to my children, not in a way that replaces me, right? In one sense, they have many fathers in the church. They don't have many, my wife doesn't have many husbands in the church. That one's unique. But, you know, our children will have many fathers and mothers in the church and grandfathers and grandmothers, and that's a good thing. But they don't replace me, right? They complement, at best, they complement what I am doing. And so I have to understand there's priority number one. You know, somebody asked me, this is comical to me, someone asked me maybe 3 or 4 weeks into marriage, so, you know, like, what have you learned in your time being married? And I'm like, whoa, we're still trying to figure out what this even is. We're still trying to figure out what we're doing here in just the basic ways and how to live together and how to organize our home. And we haven't even moved in yet fully. But I did say, well, one of the things that I realized is that my life in terms of mission has not fundamentally altered. But the way that I carry the mission out has fundamentally altered. So my life's mission is to glorify and honor the Lord and to walk faithfully with Him. That hasn't changed and will never change. What has changed is now priority number one is following Him and being faithful to Him through my work as a husband and a father. So we have to categorize and put those things there. And then you could maybe say there are other things tied to your church and your life as a churchman, your investment in the body and serving others, caring for the church, working with the saints, gathering together, not just for corporate worship, which is essential, but also to get to know one another, to have fellowship and to be a blessing to others, to show hospitality to one another, all of these commands that are given in Scripture. So we live that out in the community of faith. And yet we can live that out in one local church or the other, right? If I move across the country, okay, now I'm not obligated to these people in Jackson anymore, but I am obligated to the new people who I'm with in a new way. So that could change, but the principle is there. And then you have vocation, obviously, both what you do for work, but then also maybe if you have this idea of a greater sense of calling and the gifts that the Lord has given you, whether that's at work or at church or just talking with strangers in a coffee shop, you know, you have this sense of what the Lord has equipped you to do to further and build up the kingdom. So there are those things. And then, I mean, you could keep going down and get more granular, but I want to give maybe two more categories, which is there are the bigger tasks that are more of necessity. So these would be things, like you said, working on a fixer-upper, you know, eventually we need to replace this floor. It does bounce a little bit when we step on it. Eventually our foot's going to go through. We might have 5 years before we get there, but it needs to happen. Building skills to be able to repair a leak in the roof or fix a cabinet door that won't shut or do some basic plumbing and things like that, right? Those are task-oriented kind of basics that need to be a pursuit for dads, I think. And we need to be building those skills as we can because they're a blessing to our families. And then there's maybe another category, which the world might call hobbies, but we could call maybe loves, things that we delight in, whether it's writing or woodwork or any number of things. And those things are good and can be a form of blessing, but they should not supplant any of the other things, at least not for long. You might take some measured amount of time to pursue them, but they shouldn't supplant the other things in the other categories for very long.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I think that that's, we'll circle back to this at the end, I'm sure, but that's just a really important principle is, especially when you feel passionate about something, when you feel you might even have some kind of calling to it. Like, for instance, writing my novel was partially motivated because I kept reading fantasy fiction novels that were talking about life and death and getting it wrong. And it's like, no, that's not the way the world really is. Like, somebody needs to tell this story right. And so I think I have something to say that is good, that people will benefit from. But I think that. I know that I'm called to my family. Like, I know I'm called to love my wife because I have one. I know I'm called to raise my children in the fear of the Lord because there they are. And so we want to not neglect what we're definitely called to, and we don't want to neglect the present obedience. Because I can even talking about the more task-oriented, like, okay, this really does need to get done sort of projects. I have several of those right now. Like, okay, but sometime we really do got to do this. But in a given moment, I do have to examine my own heart. Am I wanting to do this project because it's easier than loving my wife and shepherding my children? Because it's more immediately satisfying because I see those things getting done and look, it looks so nice. Or is it because I have loved my wife faithfully, loved my children faithfully, and now I have some strength left to give today? Let me put it towards this more long-term project. I think all of that is really important.
Absolutely. And it is just so, so essential, like you said, to focus on what's in front of us, the present faithfulness. I mean, that even goes into what you said with understanding what you are definitely called to versus what you might be called to or gifted in. You are definitely obligated by the Lord to be a good husband and a good father. You're definitely obligated by the Lord to be a good churchman. You're definitely obligated by the Lord to be a good employee wherever you are for however long you're there. You might be compelled by the Lord to write a novel or to do any number of things, right? And those things could be a blessing, to have a podcast for that matter. Those things could be a blessing, and yet they can't replace the essential things. They can't replace what you know. One more principle that I have kind of thought through, and I know you have as well, is it kind of blurs the line between what we'll talk about in a bit regarding techniques, but you have to create systems. Like, you are never going to be better than the systems that you put in your life to organize your time and your efforts and kind of channel your energy. That doesn't mean that you have to be like me and be a little too OCD for your own good. I was telling some people recently at school, some teachers, that my mom, she had OCD tendencies and saw them in me as a kid. And I would count things by fours. I would go by in the grocery store, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, touching everything. And I would step in the middle of the squares on the floor. She would intentionally push me into the cracks. And not like once she did that, and I happen to remember it. Every time we went to the store, she would push me so that I had to step on the cracks. And thankfully she did, you know, she broke me of that kind of obsessive counting and things like that. But I still have the OCD tendency where I want to be really meticulous and granular with every little detail of my schedule. And that actually kind of, it leads me at times to doing what we said before, which is to not actually schedule my time because I don't think that I can really master it. I can't get the perfect schedule like I want it to be, so I don't even do it. When I actually do schedule my time, though, it's very helpful. It's very helpful to create systems and tie things together and know, okay, I've planned out what I'm going to do with my free time today, quote unquote, which isn't really a category that I think if dads were careful and moms were careful and thought about it, free time, as we think of it, isn't really a category in our lives. We might have leisure time that are things that we do want to do and spend time on, but it's not quote unquote free time like our culture might think of it. So yeah, you're not going to be any better than your systems. And we'll talk about that in a bit as well. But any other principles that you can think of as we kind of wrap up this part of the conversation?
I think one other principle that's really important as we talk about systems and as we talk about specifics, is to quote Doug Wilson in Productivity, be fruitful like a tree, not efficient like a machine. I think we have to, I mean, for myself, I have my fingers in so many pies. And even in teaching, I teach many different classes, and there's so many things that I have to think of and track and plan for and have them be ready at certain times. And I'm not a work robot. Like, I'm not just a machine that's built to complete tasks. I'm a human being. And I have specific needs and specific limitations. And my life is so much better. And yes, we could even say more productive, but even if it wasn't, my life is so much better when I am designing systems and carrying out tasks and working with a godly ambition and being okay with being finite. And being okay with the fact that maybe I plan to do one thing on an evening and that's just not going to happen because I have five kids. I was going to do one thing and then something happened in our small group and someone needs counseling or discipleship, you know? And so, I think it's good to remember, pushing the analogy, like trees will fruit at the right time and over time, and it's slow, and fruit takes time to ripen, and we can't just make things happen always when we want to, but what we can do is we can create the spaces to do those tasks and to make progress on them and then be patient with the outcomes.
Yeah, that's such a perfect metaphor because, well, maybe I'll just push it a little further to show why I think it is, because when you treat yourself like a machine, like I might do sometimes in my more OCD moments and try to squeeze out the maximum efficiency of every part of my day or every part of whatever task I'm doing, right? I'm not treating myself in a human way, and I'm not treating others around me as humans, and I'm not treating the work as a human ought to treat it. I'm treating it like a machine, which if you think about, you know, just the assembly line kind of dynamic, you have machines repeating the same task over and over, creating the same things over and over in the same way. And they're only doing that one little part of the process and then they're pushing it forward, right? Even complex machines, they might do more of the process, but they're not taking minerals out of the earth and then creating a car. They're doing a very small portion of that project, right? Even the most complex machines these days. Whereas when you think about a tree, this is what man is supposed to be. I mean, we're compared to trees all throughout the Bible for a reason. There's such a deep kind of nugget of wisdom here from the Lord, I think, because what does a tree do? It doesn't take a car, a frame of a car, and put a couple of doors on it and push it down the line. It takes sunlight and dirt and energy and I don't know what else. You're a biologist.
I like to say water from the air and distant starlight.
There you go. Water from the air and distant starlight. That's well said. And it digs down deep into the dirt and it creates an apple or an orange or a banana. That's crazy. That's insane. Yeah.
That's magic.
That trees work this way to take these kind of ethereal materials that God has made the world of that we can't even touch in some ways. I mean, we can touch water, but like light, you can't grab hold of it and see, oh, I've got this much light. Let me shove it into the tree so that it can produce an apple, right? That's not how trees work. They soak in the creation around them and transform it. And what is man made to do? Man is made to have dominion over the creation, to transform it, to glorify it, to beautify it. I mean, even this is getting away from the metaphor, but one example, right? We take trees and we make cathedrals out of the wooden beams. We take stones and cut them and put them into these high swung arches, right, that are perfectly balanced together. And that's what a tree does, right, is taking the creation and transforming it into something that transcends the basic materials that were used to make it and transcends them so dramatically that we can make an apple pie out of Granny Smith apples and taste the tartness mixed with the sweetness. And it's just not present in light. That's not present in water. You don't have tartness and sweetness mixed together. And then there's the glory of acting as a human to bring the latent potential out of the creation, not in a mechanical way, not in an efficient way, but in a beautiful way.
And I think one other part of it, just pushing the analogy a little bit further, is like you think of a robot on an assembly line in a factory that's making cars, right? What is that robot made to do? It's not made to grow. It's not made to become anything. It's made to do the thing over and over and over and then eventually break down and cease to exist. And what is the tree? Like, the tree is meant to grow and to change and to become more and to produce fruit, but also to exist for its own sake. And I think that humans are much closer to the tree than to the robot, and that we do a disservice to ourselves and others when we treat ourselves as, all right, I'm a robot built to do these tasks, and I have to do it as quickly and efficiently as possible before I break down. It's like, well, maybe that's not quite the right mindset.
Yeah, and in that way, trees are also blessings to the things around them, the creatures around them, which is what we're made to do, right? We're to be a blessing to those around us. I'm not going to say nobody, and I'm not going to say all machines, but most of the time we don't look at a machine and think, man, I'm so glad that machine is here. It's such a blessing, in the same way that we do for people or animals or trees, right? I qualify that a little bit because I did tell Megan recently, I'm so thankful for our van with the automatic sliding doors, because that's a particular answer to prayer from the Lord, actually. Not the automatic sliding doors, but the van itself. And it's just been such a blessing for us. And so we're consistently vocalizing how thankful we are to God for it, even though it's got 200,000 miles and who knows how long it will last. But we're just trusting Him, you know, let it last. So we can be thankful for technology and machines and these things, but we are not, even in those cases, we're not thankful for them in the same way. I'm thankful for the van because it makes some things a little easier. It's not producing something delightful, like a tree, like a pet, like a person for that matter. Whereas we actually do delight in other creatures, which is why that's actually, you know, kind of the reason that the big reason that we talked about starting the podcast is not because we thought, oh, well, we could reach thousands and thousands of people and be really amazing and, you know, get this following and make a lot of money and things like this. Honestly, I've told Josh, one of the best things about the podcast is just that it gets the two of us talking about these things together, and it gets us sharing ideas and learning from each other. And now you're being brought into that. And I'm just thankful for it. It's made me a better husband. It's made me a better father in the few weeks that we've been doing it already. And that's how we're designed to live as people. So, you know, as we maybe move into some more focused techniques, regarding these bigger projects and how to put these things together, maybe how to put some meat on the bone here, because these are very big principles. They're important principles. You know, let's think through, what are some systems? I said, you're never better than your systems. What are some systems that have helped you? And we can maybe go kind of back and forth here a little bit, just to make progress in little moments of time throughout your day, on your book, in the garden, right, on the house, with homeschooling, and, you know, adding in little new elements there over time, whatever it is. What are some of the things that you've kind of learned from others or discovered for yourself and put into practice that have been helpful in a very practical way?
Yeah, I think that the logical place to start here is just with priorities, which you mentioned earlier. There's just a lot of things that I want to do and be and have done, and I can't do it all. And so how do I prioritize? One thing that was really helpful to me, I think this was early high school, I was reading the Art of Manliness blog, and they had a series where they were talking about crafting the life you want. And at one point, he talks about this thing called a eulogy exercise. And I've only done this a couple of times, and this isn't something that everyone needs to do, but it was really profound and impactful to me. He said, imagine that you have passed away, but you are observing your funeral, and everyone is getting up and giving speeches. Your wife, your children, your employer, your students, in my case, and you just go on down the line. What would you want them to say? Like, what would you want them to say about you? And after thinking about that and saying, okay, I would want my kids to say this, I would want my wife to say this, then say, okay, would they actually say that? Like, truthfully, is that who you are, or is that who you want to be? And it was really helpful for me, because at the time I was really focused on all sorts of categories of, okay, I have this goal for physical fitness, and I have this goal for financial freedom, and I have this goal for this. And realizing, while all of those goals are good, I also really care about these relationships. I really care about these roles I have in relationship with others. And that eulogy exercise was a really helpful way for me to establish my big picture priorities and realize that sometimes when I have to choose between, you know, finishing my MDiv this year, or finishing my book this year, or expanding the garden this year, and being the kind of husband and father I want to be, it's easier to make that choice. I've already thought that through, and not just in a general way, but I've made clear what my goals are for what it means to be a good husband and a good father and a good employee and a good teacher. And I want to pursue those more than I want to finish this home improvement project this month, you know, that sort of thing.
That's incredibly helpful. And it's profound, because it's making me think about the eulogy that I wrote for my grandfather, which I spent a lot of time on, and I thought a lot about, and I thought about my conversations with him and my life with him, and knowing what he aspired to, and all of the ways that he, not all of the ways, I mean, the ways that I could see, right, as a grandson, all of the ways that I could see that he hit the mark, and knowing his faults, but also understanding that despite his faults, he was an incredible man, and he succeeded in, he knew what he wanted people to think about him and to say about him, because I talked about it with him late in his life, and he just kind of opened up to me, and it was true. He hit it. And so I tried to kind of carefully think about how to say those things about him, but it's got me thinking, man, you said not everybody necessarily needs to do that. I want to maybe push back on that and say, yes, we do. We need to consider our death. We need to consider our mortality and understand, like you said earlier, that we can't do everything. There are going to be so many things left undone. I mean, this is one of the things that Lewis says about the value of unread books, having a book on a bookshelf, having many books on your bookshelf that you haven't read. One of the benefits is that it cultivates humility, because you look at it and you say, even if you read 50 books a year, if you're reading 50 books a year, right, you're going to have a lot of books on your bookshelf. And you would say, I'm never going to read all of those. I'm always going to have more books than I can read. And that's a healthy thing, because it helps you to remember, I can't possess all knowledge. I can't do everything. So what are the things that I must do? What are the things that I need people to say of me at my funeral, for instance, or when I'm dead one day? And man, that is so helpful, because it helps you reckon with just your own mortality and limited finite nature. I think that's incredible. And it dovetails very nicely with, I've mentioned early on the podcast, Atomic Habits by James Clear. That might have been the first or second book that I recommended. He talks about a similar kind of idea where, as you know, thinking about systems, as you have goals, you don't need to think about the goal so much as the kind of person that achieves the goal. So if I want to run a marathon, I don't need to think about, okay, I've got this goal and I'm going to kind of map it out and think through it, and I'm going to get the marathon one day. Like, that's my focus, is finishing that. My focus actually needs to be, what kinds of things does a marathon runner do every day? Because that's tangible. I can touch that. I can see it. Does a marathon runner wake up 15 minutes before work and show up to work? Or does a marathon runner wake up 2 hours before work and get out and train? That's what I need to be thinking about. And then I need to be honest with myself and say, am I a marathon runner, or am I a lazy bum, right? I don't know if I can actually say that those of us who aren't running marathons are lazy bums. That's not fair to many of us. Although we certainly can be at times, but I hate running. So I just have to defend those of us who aren't passionately obsessed with running, what is it, 26.3 miles, something like that. You need to envision the kind of day that the kind of person you want to be would live, and then do it. Just live that kind of life each day and practice it. Like you said, you know, practice makes progress. You're not going to reach the marathon in a day, but you are going to get out and run a little bit if that's what you are aspiring to do, if that's what you're aspiring to be. You're not going to perfectly pay attention to your children and meet all their needs and love them and do all of those things in one day. But if you focus on that, you will make progress in it. You'll start to see the ways that you can do it, even when you're exhausted coming home from work, you know, even when you're tired of pretending in this game for the 100th time this week, right? Or reading this book for the 20th time in 3 days. You can make progress in those areas by remembering the kind of man you want to be would do this. And so I'm going to do it because I want to be him.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that too, talked about in terms of like identity-based habits. And a way I've, for instance, worked on that with my book is like, okay, what would a writer do? Well, a writer would have times that he says he's going to write, and then he does it, you know. A writer would write every day. A writer would. And then what does that look like? I can make that really easy on myself. So, for instance, when I wanted to start becoming more healthy, I sit at a desk all day, and I need more exercise. I said, I want to do a lot more push-ups and calisthenics. And so I said, okay, well, here's what I'll do. Just every morning, I'll just drop down, I'll knock out 50 push-ups. And that worked for like one-ish day, you know? And then the next morning, I didn't feel like it. And so how do I help myself do hard things? Well, one of the things I would do is say, okay, well, how about instead what I'll say is that certain times every day, I'm going to do 2 push-ups. And then when I get down and I go to do 2 push-ups, I'm like, well, I'm already down here, and so I might as well do some more. And then I end up doing a lot more than 2 push-ups, but giving yourself those kind of easy entry into things can make it a lot easier. And I think your example with the kids is really helpful too, because I can look at it and say, okay, you know, if I walk into the room and I'm tired and my kids are all jumping on me, like, what kind of dad do I want to be? What would he do? Well, he would play with them, you know, and maybe it won't be for very long because we got to go in and figure out dinner, or we got to do this, or we got to do that, we've got to go somewhere. But I can, in this moment, choose to react based on who I want to be. Because I think that's the other part of it, too, is that when we look at really big tasks, we can get overwhelmed at all the work that there is. It can be overwhelming to think of just how much of my life will be spent as a horsey for my kids. And yet I don't have to have the stamina for a lifetime of being a horsey right now. I just need to have the stamina for 10 minutes until mom calls us in for dinner. Right. And I can do that. I can play horsey for 10 minutes. And so I think that's an important part too, is not thinking about obedience as future, but as present, not thinking about who I'm going to be tomorrow when I feel more like that. And instead, like, what can I choose to do right now to lean into this identity of who I want to be?
Man, the horse example is good. It also brings to mind a funny moment that I'm thinking of from the other day. So I saw Nate Bargatze's dead horse bit, where it's like this 10-minute joke about a dead horse and like, how do you get rid of a dead horse? How do you get friends to agree to help you move a dead horse off of your yard? Because he thought he saw one, and it turns out the horse was sleeping, and he learned that horses sleep on the ground, you know, laying down. And so there's recently, Levi jumped on me when I was laying on the ground. He's like, can you be a horse now? Because he had just fought me and killed me as a giant or something. And he said, can you be a horse now? And so I'm laying on the ground. And I said, you know, horses sleep laying down, right? And I was just, you know, pretending to sleep for a second before I got up and walked around with him. But I think that's so important with our kids, understanding this idea of the kind of dads we want to be. I want to focus it back on some of these bigger tasks that aren't maybe essential. So one of mine would be aspiring to build things with my hands in the shop out of wood, right? Aspiring to learn different kinds of woodcraft and carpentry skills to be a blessing to my family, but also because I just enjoy it and I want to make beautiful things. I want to make countertops for our kitchen, like butcher block countertops, and I have the wood for it. I might have the skill for it. I have the tools for it. But one of the things that you kind of hinted at, but maybe didn't mention explicitly, is that sometimes you see the magnitude of a task and have to break it down into little parts. And sometimes those parts involve just creating the space, preparing the space to do what it is that you want to do. So do I want to be a reader? Do I want to read 50 books this year? Where am I going to read 50 books? Like literally in my house, where am I going to sit to read these books? What is that going to look like? Envision it. And one of the most helpful things that I've started to try to do in these different areas of life is to build the space in your home around that and to set it up where, like you said, two push-ups is an easy kind of entry point into doing push-ups. Sitting down at a desk that's cluttered and has a month worth of things piled on top of it, you know, that is not easy to sit down and do. But if I prepare the space, if I think through, okay, what do I need here to sit down and read? You know, do I need a lamp or something like that? Then I can be more effective. Similarly, recently I went out to the shop and I cleaned the whole shop. And rather than doing any woodworking, I spent about 45 spare minutes just cleaning, because if you think about a master carpenter, what kind of shop does he have? Well, he has one that's functional. He has one where the tools go where they belong. And, you know, there's not wood chips and all kinds of trash piled all over the place. So I just spent some time cleaning it out and preparing the space.
Yeah, I think that's all really great. And I think another thing that's really helpful with big projects, at least something that's been really helpful to me, is the acronym SMART for SMART goals. And partnering that with reflection. So I actually do this with my students sometimes. You know, if I have a paper due, if I look at my calendar and I pick a day and I write due paper in all caps, that like gives me stress and it's not even real. And so what do I need to do? I need to break that up into pieces, and then the acronym, I need to make it specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-based. So specific, I know exactly what I'm doing in that time. It's measurable. I can see whether I did it or not. You know, if my goal is just to work on stuff, I don't know if that was a very productive time or not. Making sure it's attainable, it's relevant to my overarching goals, and then time-bound, scheduling it in time and that sort of thing. But the part that really helps me with this too is the reflection. So when I started writing, I had all these ideas, I had these scenes in my mind, and so then I expected that I would just write them. You know, I'd just sit down, and then there they would be on the paper, and that was a lot harder. There was a very significant disconnect between what was in my mind and what I was able to communicate on the page. And initially, it was just very discouraging, and I also didn't have a good space set aside, like you're talking about, and so I'd be like, well, I'm sitting on my computer, so wonder if there's anything new on YouTube, because that just feels so much easier than this hard thing that I'm trying to do. And so looking at it and instead saying, okay, last time I tried to sit down and write, it was really hard and I didn't feel like I could do it, and then I ended up watching YouTube. So let me reflect on that. Like, what was the cause of that? Why did I not make the progress I hoped to? Was it that I didn't break it up into enough milestone goals? Was it that I wasn't specific enough about what I was sitting down to do? Because if I have time in my schedule every week to work on my book, it's very easy when that time comes to work on something else, because it's just very vague. But once I recognize that that happens, that if I'm not specific in my planning, that I'm more likely to just end up doing other things, well, then I was able to plan for that. It's like, okay, I'm going to work on my book this time, this day. What am I working on? Let's edit this scene in Act 1. That still doesn't feel quite right. And then it's very specific. It's measurable. I can see whether I edited it or not. And if I, it's attainable to do it in the time that I have. It's relevant to my overarching goal of finishing the book and having it be worth reading. And I have it planned in time. But then if it doesn't work, taking that time to reflect afterwards and say, what went wrong? Was it that I bit off more than I could chew, that I didn't realize I needed to do X before I could do Y, that I didn't have a good space planned for it, that I didn't plan enough time or the right time of day? Because at the end of the day, if I keep practicing at it, I will get better at it. Something I say to my kids all the time, because I'm trying to help them with this, is they'll start something new and they won't be perfect at it the first time they pick up a basketball or something. And I'll say, what did you expect? Like, you expected to be good at something that you've never done before? That doesn't make sense. And yet we do that all the time with ourselves. And so I try to tell my kids, like, yeah, if you want to get good at this, you got to practice. And they're like, oh, but this kid's really good at it. It's like, right, because they've practiced a lot. And they've practiced in the right ways. And the way we figure out what those right ways are is by getting in and just making a mess at first. That's what I tell people when they're looking to get into gardening. And sometimes they're kind of hesitant. Oh, I'm afraid I'm going to kill a plant. Like, you will. You will definitely kill your plants. Like, go ahead and adjust your expectations. The first year, nothing. It was just a waste of time, except you will have learned so much, and the second year will be better, and the third year will be even better. And so, yeah, sometimes you just have to get in there and make a mess. As long as you are reflecting and learning from it, and then, yeah, being specific in your planning afterwards, you get somewhere after a while.
I think specificity is so important, because I can say, well, I want to go practice woodworking or build something or make a project. And if I don't have anything in mind, I go out to the shop, I twiddle my thumbs a little bit, I poke some wood with a stick maybe or something like that, and then I leave, right? And I end up calling it quits early. Whereas if I have a project in mind specifically, or even a part of a project specifically that I need to work on, then I go out and I do that. And that's all that I do. And then I come back in, which is so great. And maybe this will be helpful to kind of come to the end here where we want to talk about balance. It's so great to be specific ahead of time, because then you know when you're done, and you need to know when you're done in order to have balance in your life with these things. Like, you need to have an end goal in your mind when you sit down to write this book, because otherwise you could try to spend 3 hours at a time writing this book, which is, at least most of the time, probably not actually attainable. Or if it is attainable, not healthy for your relationship to your family. That's right. And so let's think about that a little bit, because there are many systems that we could talk about and that do work, but none of it matters if these projects are getting in the way of the most important things, like we've talked about before. So how do you approach trying to balance these lesser projects, so to speak, these things that don't have to be done, but that you would love to do, and that could be even beneficial to do for others, for your family? How do you balance that with the things that must be done?
Yeah, I think that there's a balance from multiple angles here, you know? So for instance, I can be lazy and attempt nothing and just seek to do the bare minimum, or I can be ambitious. And I think there is a godly ambition that we should pursue, and that it extends beyond just just evangelizing and discipling, though that's an essential part of it. I think that I can have a godly ambition in many areas. And I also just have to really keep a close eye on my heart. I think of what you were talking about earlier of, like, we have these things that we want to do, that we think we're supposed to do, and then these things we need to do. And I think the one that is central, that is foundational to all of these, is disciple. Like, I am a follower of Christ. And if I, you know, see these projects and they're good things that I want to do to bless others, that and I enjoy, that I think glorifies God in some way, but then I am doing it instead of pursuing wholehearted obedience to the Lord, you know, where I say, oh, well, I was going to get up early this morning, you know, to get some writing done before work started, but I didn't. So now I have to choose between writing or getting some devotional time. Well, as soon as I'm choosing writing there, without being legalistic about something, it's showing something in my heart, right? It's showing that I am making an idol out of this thing. And so for myself, everyone's different, but for myself, I am made to work. Like, the Lord has made me to work. I realized the other day that almost all of my hobbies are work. that almost all of my leisure is work. That doesn't make sense. Isn't that supposed to be leisure? And I think that that's okay. Though me getting back into drawing a bit more was partially to have something that was less work-centric, but it's still something I'm doing, trying to make something. But anyways, I'm made to work, but I have to be asking myself all the time, like, what is this for? And I think of Indy Wilson's Death by Living. It's a follow-up to Notes from a Tilt-a-Whirl. But he just really drills it home, this memento mori that we've been talking about, the fact that one day you will die, that your, I think he says, your heartbeats can't be hoarded, that your breath is draining away. Like, you've only got so many breaths, you've only got so many heartbeats, so use your muscles while they last. Let your bones groan while they still can, because they can't do anything in the grave. And so when I look at that, I want to have that godly ambition of dying by living. Like, I'm dying no matter what I do, so let it be being poured out for people around me and doing the projects that I think are worth doing and pursuing. But the projects aren't the end in themselves, even the things that need to be done. And so, I don't know, I'm all over the place, but I think my initial answer to your question of, like, how do I try to balance this, is I try to first really strongly root my identity in Christ and in the gospel. And then from there, I can be much more open-handed about my work, about my projects, about how I spend my time. And so even if I have like a defined time where I say, okay, from 3 to 4, I'm going to be working on this project, that when my wife comes in and hands me a screaming baby and says that she's got another one that she's got to deal with, that I just accept that, you know, that I am okay with that. And it, when I find that I'm not okay with that, that's often a clue that there's some idolatry creeping into my heart, and that I'm pursuing this project not as an open-handed thing, not as trying to glorify God, but as trying to seek praise of man or pride in myself, or even just living selfishly for my own desires. So I think that's one essential part of it, is just examining your own heart over and over, because the right thing to do and the motive of why you're doing it both matter. And if you're not paying attention to that, you aren't going to drift into doing that well.
Yeah, I think one of the things there I'd like to seize on is just the willingness to be interrupted when you're pursuing these things. That has to be there. It's got to be something that you understand, like whether that's writing a book or me out in the shop or even working on a project with the house, right? If I'm back there busting up this concrete to try to plant some grass so that the kids have a bigger yard to play in, that's great. And it's something that I'm seeking to do as a blessing. But, you know, I've got to be willing to be interrupted in that and to be taken out of it to come and jump into the family and help out where needed and you know, put that aside for the moment, because it's meant to be a blessing, right? It's not meant to be something that brings cursing, that brings destruction or mayhem or chaos. I mean, this is similar to the idea that Jesus is speaking of when he speaks of the Sabbath, right? That the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. This was always meant to be a blessing for man. And the Pharisees are turning it into a curse, right? They're turning it into drudgery and this thing that is absolutely anti-life. It's sucking the life out of the people who are listening to them. And his point is, no, this is supposed to be life-giving. And maybe tied to that, and if I can kind of jump into something else that you said, is this idea that, yes, we're made to work, right? I think that's one of the biggest things that I would say in trying to balance, is that our balance is different kinds of work. That's what I was kind of alluding to with the idea of free time. And you were even mentioning, like, this is my leisure. My leisure is work. Because in one sense, I mean, that is what leisure is. If we went back 400 years and said, hey, what do you do in your leisure time? If you have leisure time, if you're wealthy enough to have leisure, they would say, well, I pursue education. Like, I learn Greek and Latin and read books in Greek and Latin, or I am learning to paint from a master, because that's what we think of those things as hard work. And like, that's discipline and rigorous and all of this. You know, students at school think about education this way, and it is work, but this is the kind of work that is leisurely because it's not you slaving away in a mine somewhere 100 feet underground, right? The time that people had away from that, they pursued these noble tasks that actually bring beauty and glory to the people around them and build up. And so that would be my last thing in terms of trying to strike a balance is it's much easier to strike a balance when, well, maybe two more things. It's much easier to strike a balance when you are doing things that are profitable and that are not wasting away, like you said, your breath, wasting away the strength in your muscles. Even if that profit isn't, you know, measured in dollars or something tangible and physical that you can see, right? The notion of writing a good story, and even if 10 people read your book one day, right, that could be a profit to them. It could be a blessing to them, is a good one. Or even just to your family, right? To Jenna and the kids, they could read the book and be blessed by the story and get to know you more, as husband and father, and wrestle with these ideas alongside you. So that is good. And the last thing I'll say is, I had a professor tell me this in a pastoral ministry class that, and you've heard this, I know as well, that you're investing consistently in this relational bank with your family. And sometimes he's talking as a pastor, sometimes you have demands on you as a pastor that draws you away from your family, maybe even at important moments. And you need to have the capital to make a withdrawal from the bank because you've built up so much good relational connection with your children, with your wife. And that's similar in many areas, right? I have to be building up capital in order to pursue things that I want to pursue, writing, podcasting, woodworking, you know, whatever it is, projects around the house, right? I can't just be spending all of my time on those things because then I don't have any capital to withdraw.
Yeah, and I think the one other thing I would say is I think the wisdom of Ecclesiastes is really helpful here. And just receiving life and enjoying it for what it is and recognizing that these projects that we pursue are good. And because of the priesthood of all believers, because of all things being made new, like the work that I do can be seen unto eternity in the work that I do for Christ. But in another sense, my work is so transitory, right? Like this book, even if it's a New York Times bestseller, will be forgotten, right? Like any projects that you make out in your shop will not last, however well you make them, forever. And so the things that we do can be so temporary, and it's helpful to remember that we ourselves are not. Right? Like in your family, in your home, there is all the stuff around your house is impermanent, but you are surrounded by immortal souls, and you yourself are an immortal soul. And I think that's a really important principle when it just comes to how you spend your time and the projects you pursue and that sort of thing. Thinking of writing a book, for instance, is how they shape you. And the virtue that comes from working diligently at a task, even when it is not always leading to the outcome that you want, right? We could do a whole nother episode about AI sometime. But, you know, one of my concerns about AI is that we shortcut the becoming of who we get to be through doing those things ourselves. And even if we get a product at the end of it that is comparable, it's temporary. It's transitory. It won't last. But who we become as we are molded into the image of Christ, working faithfully and then resting, but resting in security, resting in what Christ has accomplished in the gospel, and then working diligently while we still have breath. We want to become like him through all of it.
That's perfect. And a good note to end on. In the vein of becoming and growing and being stretched and shaped, what book do you have for us this week? You know, on the podcast, we give book recommendations. And so the floor is yours. What you got for us? What what should we read in order to become more like the image of Christ?
Yeah, well, what I would say would be Productivity by Doug Wilson, but Guthrie up and took that one early on. So if I have to recommend a book, I think I would like to recommend Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy. It's often called one of the greatest novels ever written, and that's because it is. At least it's the greatest novel I've ever read. I think it's one of the most important books that a present-day American could read. If you read it, however, be prepared, because it's not a plot-centric novel, but a character-centric novel. It's slow, it's rambling, but the characters are so real, and the ideas are so much more powerful because of it. I want to tell you all about it, but I think I'll just say that he asks a lot of really good questions in it. What makes love last? How should we care about society's rules? Can money and status and pleasure ever really satisfy us? Where do we find meaning? And you know he's done a really good job in making the arguments when it's recommended by people from all over the world. Like Al Mohler thinks this is one of the best books ever written, and so does Oprah Winfrey, and for opposite reasons. So you know he made the arguments really strongly in both directions. That I side with Mohler, though. I think he did an excellent job of showing the fruit of Christian living and the destruction that comes with just living for yourself and for your passions, and living not in accordance with the Word. I also think it's really important because it precedes the Communist Revolution and the rise of Stalin. And I think that if you read Tolstoy, it's not just about understanding love and family. It's about understanding the history of ideas that came about at that time. And I think it's really essential that we today learn to reflect on what led to the evil of Stalinism, lest we repeat those same mistakes. So a little bit of a subject change, but I think a really important book for virtue formation and for current events, though it is hefty, so you might take it in a couple of doses rather than try to read it all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Russian novel, so it has to be, right? Yeah. Like, you're pushing 600 pages on one of the lightweight Russian novels, I think, so.
Yeah. No, I have a short story that is as big as other books on my shelf.
I believe it. Yeah, I mean, you've told me about it a little bit, and I look forward to reading it someday. I want to maybe put it on the list of audiobooks. I've got a few things I'm listening to right now. One of them, actually, that I know I'm going to recommend, but I need to finish it first. And so maybe I'll recommend that in a few weeks. But I'd love to add that to list because I'm actually very ignorant in Russian literature. I haven't read any, at least not any full-length works. And you've highly recommended this one, so I want to start there. My book for this week is Lord of the Flies by William Golding. It is pretty short, opposite of anything by Tolstoy. It is maybe a couple hundred pages at most, I think. And it's a book about little boys, like school-age boys, who get lost on an island. Plane crashes into the sea. They're stranded. It's just the boys. None of the adults survive. They're English boys, and the author is British, and so he's drawing on some British tropes throughout the book. But he actually says in an introduction to the book that his point that he wanted, he was talking to his wife once, and you know, he says, people always talk about how saintly little children are and how wonderful they are and how, you know, society corrupts them and all of these things. And he said, that's not true. And his wife said, apparently, you should write a book about it. And he's like, yeah, maybe I will. And so he writes this book, you know, with just these boys on the island to show really the depth of our sin and depravity and self-interest and the depth of our animosity towards one another as people. Because almost instantly, factions start dividing on the island, and these boys who were classmates are now at war. It's a brutal book. It is a hard read in many ways, but it is absolutely profound in terms of his treatment of human nature and the depth of our willingness to do wickedness to one another and to distort and corrupt within society. So yeah, Lord of the Flies by William Golding. It's a great read, one of the books we read at school with the eighth graders, and they're always shocked by it, but also I think upon reflecting on it, they really enjoy the book. Well, that's all the time we have for this evening. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. Please feel free to follow us over on Substack if you want to see what we're writing about. You can see a link to Shane Caver's music down in the description of the podcast. We want to thank him for the use of our theme music. And please feel free to share the show with a friend if you've enjoyed it. So until next time, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show. You have to say, don't be hasty.
Don't be hasty.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so here's how you kill a hydra. You cut off one head and two more pop up, but that says nothing about its blood or lungs or lung capacity, right? So you get in there, you whack off a couple of heads, you pop back, and you wait for it to black out.